Now, a night I've been waiting for a long time. I love it when David Cerritta joins us on the program. We've got lots to talk with him about UFOs. He's got a new movie out in April called From Here to Andromeda. We're going to be talking about just mysticism and all kinds of things, a search for extraterrestrial life. This is one of those coast-to-coast nights that if you're in the Midwest and you're freezing your toes off, just kind of sit back in bed or on a couch with a blanket. Grab a glass of wine and keep your radio turned on. Keep by the phone in case you want to interact when it's time for calls. And enjoy yourself. If you're driving, enjoy yourself. And if you're just, I don't know, enjoy yourself. We'll be back in a moment. David Cerritta's first aspiration of life was to become an astronaut in 1968. He and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After this experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields, and he has studied world religion, science, physics, and paranormal psychology for more than 25 years. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hello, David. Welcome back. How are you?
Hello, George. Happy Valentine's Day to you and everybody out there.
Thank you. You're very kind. By the way, you're going to get a kick out of this. I was talking to my producers today, and I said, you know what I'd like to do beginning in March, maybe once a week, is to pick one major UFO case, whatever it might be, and to do a complete program on that case and digest it with a guest or an expert for that particular UFO issue and case. And I think that would work well, don't you?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that needs to happen is when you go deeper into one, you know, case or one subject, you know, people just get so much more out of it. A lot of what happens on television, for example, two weeks ago I was on Fox National on Heartland, and it was great to be on the show, but before you can even blink an eye, you're off the show, and it's over. And they had Bill Nye, the science guy, and I'm a big Bill Nye fan. I mean, yeah. I thought he is just a riot to learn science from. And there he was debunking UFOs, and I started talking. The host of the show, John, asked me, you know, why am I such a believer? And first I talked about my experience, but then I said I rely on the experiences of expert witnesses, and I mentioned the case of Gordon Cooper at Edwards Air Force Base, and then I started to go into the case of Major Bob White, who's the fastest man alive in 1962. He's test flying the X-15 supersonic at Mach 6. And he testified in Time magazine that right outside of his window, there's a UFO going Mach 6. And there's not two X-15s. There's only one. And
exactly.
Of course, it's not the Chinese. But when you really go deeply, you could go so deeply into just Edwards Air Force Base. I mean, that in my new film, From Here to Andromeda, I cite three or four major cases there. So Gordon Cooper doesn't stand alone. And I was also reading your article in UFO magazine, Matt Magruder, the Matt Magruder story that you were writing. And that's something I never knew, you know, another major, you know, military expert witness, you know, and that's what needs to happen. Go so deep into one case at a time. I think people would really get more out of it.
I do, too. I think we're going to start doing some of that. And I want to talk with you a lot about some UFO cases, but obviously we want to get into your new work that you're working on now as well. Dan Aykroyd, about a week or so ago, was talking about this incredible UFO O'Hare video. I got to assume you were part of that.
Well, I told Dan, I was at, you know, visiting with him. My fiancée, Crystal, and I were, you know, visiting with him in New York. And while we were filming our new movie, and while we were in New York later in the talk tonight, we were interviewing Robert Thurman, who was the closest to the Dalai Lama as far as being an American scholar in Tibetan Buddhism.
Right.
He teaches at Columbia College, and I got a very deep inside interview with him about UFOs from the Tibetan Buddhist perspective, and also about their invisible cities, of which there are many interdimensional invisible cities, such as Shambhala and the Copper Mountain Paradise, and that it's just one of the most amazing dialogues I've ever had, because I've never seen, in fact, my friend Bob Simone has actually interviewed the Dalai Lama himself on the subject of UFOs, so there's really a lot there. I mean, if you go deep into Hinduism and Buddhism and even Old Testament stuff, there's a lot of information on the subject in all of the different religions in the world. So,
what's your take on this O'Hare UFO episode?
Well, I actually interviewed John Hilkovich at the reporter.
Yeah.
And I just really commend him in the courage that it took for a major newspaper to report this story on New Year's Day, and then all of a sudden to, you know, he told me, Hilkovich told me, they got more hits on their website for that story than any story in history, in the history of the Chicago Tribune online. And then he files the Freedom of Information Act request against the FAA, and that is courageous. I mean, wow. It's like the New York Times. It's that equivalent, or the LA Times, filing an FOA saying, you're hiding the truth here, because we have, you know, a dozen or so United Airlines employees, and these guys are outside, you know, loading airplanes with luggage. They know what every common airplane looks like.
Everything. So, they know every light in the sky, David.
They know everything. And, you know, when they say weather phenomena, you think these guys don't know what a cloud looks like? I mean, these guys are outdoor workers. You know, when you work outside, and I've done the same thing planting trees in British Columbia, when you're outside, I mean, you know everything. You know, because you're out there. When people are in their offices, you know, they all day long and for decades, you know, the only time they get outside is to get into their car. They don't really have a lot of experience. And I think this case is an icon. I mean, it really stands out above them all. And then later, what he says is that the FAA finally responds to him, and they said, yes, they were talking about the UFOs like crazy on the airwaves. So he's got them to admit that. And then he said that there were over 50 civilian witnesses. And you think about how rare it is when you're in an airport, you know, gate C-17 in Chicago here. You know, I've been to Chicago. How many times do you even come up to the glass and look at the airplanes compared to people just sitting in their chairs? So the odds that a civilian would get a photograph, according to one of the United Airlines workers who went on Rents.com, it was a 20-minute sighting. He estimated the disc to be 30 feet wide. It was, you know, metallic gray, and it, you know, just shot straight up and punched a hole in the clouds. Now, the chances of anyone leaning up against the glass and then getting a steep enough view upwards, you know, he's saying 700 to 1,500 feet above, you know, ground level. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty steep angle, so I'm not surprised that there are no real photographs that have surfaced yet. And one of the problems, again, in these cases, you get these debunkers going out there, and they're the ones who are putting the fake photos all over the internet.
Exactly.
And that destroys the story. And already the eyewitnesses have said, you know, themselves, because they saw it, they go, that's not what we saw. So whoever these people are who are putting these photos on the internet, I think they're part of the cover-up. And they may
be...
Might be right. You know, they're blurring this thing. It's the same thing in crop circle research. You know, these people who actually make a living going out and making fake circles, they're kind of, you know, obscuring the truth here. And they know there's a real phenomena going on, but they have to mess it all up. But one of the things that interests me about O'Hare, very consistently, the eyewitnesses saw the shimmering waves coming off of the UFO, which kind of blur the light around it. And that is so consistent with real videography or real sightings of UFOs. Like if you look at some of the footage from Jaime Musan in Mexico during that eclipse, you can see this silver disc and it's pulsing, but it's not as crisp as a, you know, 747 or a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of the waves actually distorting the photons, and that's what the eyewitnesses said. That's what I saw at Berkeley in 1968 as well. So the waves have a lot to do with the propulsion systems. And then you consider this thing suddenly accelerating straight up into the clouds. I mean, first of all, the very fact that it can suddenly accelerate would tell me once again that I'm on the right track as far as the theoretical propulsion physics, and that is that they are reducing the mass gravity effect by wave transforming the atoms in the craft and the pilot so that they can cancel out gravity, not increase mass gravity, but actually cancel it out. So gravity has no effect on them. So that was really curious to me, how fast, and I think that's one of the reasons a lot of these military pilots can't accept, oh, it couldn't be real, it's got to be weather phenomena, because nothing could bolt that fast straight up.
Well, and we're getting these reports now, David, all around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me throw a whole bunch of things out here and give me your theory on this. UFO reports from all around the planet. Birds dropping dead out of the sky. Now we find out that almost half the bee population in the country, the honeybees, that mm-hmm. they may be dead.
Oh, my God.
I mean, what is going on? It's almost as if you believe in these extraterrestrial visitations, we are being monitored for a specific reason. They're not getting involved, but they're witnessing something. They're witnessing an event. They want to watch something. I think if they were going to jump in and try to bail us out of a problem, they would have done that by now. That's not occurring. Mm-hmm. There's something else going on here. I can't put my finger on it. What about you?
Well, you have the sighting in North Carolina. We had an amazing sighting very recently, just north of Phoenix near Flagstaff. This kid was coming home from school and drew these beautiful drawings of a disc-shaped flying saucer.
How about the colonel in Arkansas who took those?
The colonel in Arkansas, the military colonel. And in fact, I've written him. And then you also have this case in Hawaii. I mean, we're kind of getting swarmed. And actually, just 3 nights ago, I had this experience, and I've had 3 of these before, and I've never really talked about this on radio, but in the middle of the night, in my lucid dream state, this beam of light comes, you know, blasting down on me, and it's thunderously loud, and it's making this pulsing sound. I mean, it's a classic, you know, Travis Walton type of beam, you know, from the Travis Walton case. And as the beam strikes me, I become paralyzed. I lose control of my, you know, my functions, you know, my arms, my legs, mm-hmm. my brain. And there's a feeling of helplessness as the beam is on me. I mean, it's terrifying. It's so loud and it's electric. And part of me, you know, thinks, you know, maybe this is a preparation for the rapture, you know, for certain Christians who believe in the rapture, that we will all be taken off the planet. And there's even other religions who actually believe in that same sort of idea that when, you know, there's an iconoclasm on the earth, you know, Mother Nature destroys the world, or we go into a state of war, triggering nuclear war, that a lot of us will be taken, you know, aboard these giant ships. Some people think they'll be teleported to the, you know, the side of their master. But that's part of what was going through my mind, and I was very conscious. You know, my girlfriend's lying next to me, and I just woke up screaming in terror because of this overwhelming fear of losing control. And I've had, you know, many years, actually in early 1994, just after the L.A. earthquake, I was living in Century City Towers on the 22nd floor, and I had a beam of light, and I wonder how these beams do this, how they interdimensionally go through the walls, because this thing was so bright when I opened my eyes. It was like from another dimension.
Yeah.
I mean, my eyes
yeah.
were open, this thunderously bright beam of light came over me, and it was actually a beautiful feeling. There was this feeling of totally transcending the human body, and there were these harmonic vibrational tones. It was like music, you know, going up several octaves one at a time, and each octave the atoms in my body became more and more higher and higher frequencies, more and more transparent. And it got to the point that I couldn't think a thought if I tried it. I opened my eyes and I could see this field of light surrounding me that was so, so bright. And eventually, when I got to the 7th octave, I thought, oh, my God, you're going to get beamed up aboard a ship here. And even to have that thought was a miracle. And finally, I got into my body, and I got up, and I knocked on my roommate's door, and I said, I may not be here in the morning. I mean, it literally feels like that. And I think there are a lot of people. In fact, in my movie From Here to Andromeda, I interviewed, you know, a good friend of mine who is a Vietnam War vet, Hinton Harrison, and he talked about going to Shasta and sitting on the top of the mountain at 3 in the morning, and, you know, his girlfriend was sitting in his van, and this beam of light just came right down on top of him and enveloped him. And I think these beams, in fact, they have appeared in crop circles. They have appeared interdimensionally in photographs. People have seen them show up in photographs in crop circles, fields. There was a small town in Colorado that on the front page of their little newsletter, I had this photograph, and apparently everybody saw this pillar of light, I mean, just right in the middle of the town, and nobody knew where it was coming from. So it's kind of a bit of a phenomenon to have experiences. I've had experiences with 3 of them, and it got to the point that I thought maybe they're getting me ready, you know, and they're getting a lot of people ready to this moment, this thing that...
Well, it's kind of funny. David Jacobs, whom you know, his theory is that, one, this is not a good thing that's going on, but he does believe that we are being prepared for something. Mm-hmm. And, again, he doesn't think it's a good thing, but something's going on. And it's interesting to hear you say something's going on.
Well, yeah, because it's in timing to all these sightings. I haven't had an experience with one of these beams of light, and, you know, I practice meditation every single day. I mean, it's my life, and, you know, I'm Catholic mystic, and I'm a very devoted practitioner. And I, you know, I ask for protection, you know, from the angels, and I really do believe that something really powerful, something mind-blowing is about to happen on this planet.
I think you're right. Quick question, then we're going to talk at the half here when we come back about your new movie and some mm-hmm. incredible things you're doing with Singularity. Mm-hmm. France, Brazil, Russia, all trying to disclose a little bit more about UFOs, releasing files, information. What's going on there? Why are they doing this?
I think they're doing it because it's getting so obvious that there's a phenomena going on here. You know, it's becoming undeniable, and it's almost embarrassing that mainstream media, you know, meaning television, still, you know, other than the History Channel, which I think does a pretty good job of getting the general story out there. But there's nothing better than radio to really get the truth. But because of, you know, your show even, I think that there's too many people that are electrified by this phenomenon. They're saying, hey, you know, we want answers. And in countries like France, you know, they're being very progressive. You know, I've seen the news, and, you know, they're going to disclose thousands of UFO file cases. But the one thing that's still missing here, you know, for everybody, is clear, unmistakable contact with a particular civilization who identify themselves and their intent with us. That is still not 100% clear. I mean, it can be 100% clear for an experiencer on an individual basis, and I think that is the way it has been going on for perhaps even hundreds or thousands of years. There are certain people who receive divine contact, you know, whether it's, you know, religious, spiritual, and or UFOs, and those beings act as teachers, and they take upon a pupil. For example, you know, I cite the case in my new movie of Pythagoras. This is in Peter Gorman's book, Pythagoras, the Life. Rutledge, Keegan, and Paul Press out of London in the 1970s publication. That's when the last reprint was. And in here, you know, Pythagoras, the great mathematician, who, you know, is famous for what? For the triangular theorem.
Mm-hmm.
And also the foundations of, you know, Western music. He is saying that he grew up with a brother who was an extraterrestrial, a star child, basically.
Yes, hybrid.
You know, a hybrid, and his father, Pythagoras' father, notices this child sitting on the side of the road staring without blinking at the sun and sipping dewdrops out of leaves, and he doesn't blink. He's looking at the sun, and the only cases of anybody being able to do something like that, you know, go into, you know, deep states of trance and meditation, very powerful, you know, yogis have these abilities, and saints, there are many examples, you know, of Catholic saints who can walk through fire and stare at the sun without, you know, burning their retinas. And the father notices this and goes, oh, my God, this child doesn't even look, you know, human. And remember the Matt Magruder case, you know, which you wrote the article in UFO Magazine, how much he said the aliens at Roswell they looked more human than not human.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, when I was reading that, I was going, you know, that's what it must have been like for Pythagoras' father. This wasn't obviously a green alien with little skinny arms. Like in Spielberg's movie, this is more human-looking, but definitely not like us. And he becomes Pythagoras' stepbrother, and he grows up with him, and he becomes a teacher. And Pythagoras, in a way, becomes his pupil. And what interests me, for example, even, and this is in my new film, in the Phoenix Lights case, one of the things I extrapolate or point out is that these giant triangular UFOs, and repeatedly triangles, stop at right in front of the Estrella mountain range, in which Estrella in Spanish means star mountain, which goes further back to the Greek Astraeos, which is star child. And I think maybe symbolically they could be communicating with us on a subtle level to say that the master architects have returned. You know,
almost, David, like a code. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. We're going to talk about some of his new work, absolutely incredible work. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. David, do you still want to be beamed into space?
I would. I actually, you know, I'm a skydiver, George. So I took up skydiving after some very deep mystical experiences I had to kind of lose my fear of, you know, being attached to the planet and the body. And also part of my own astronaut training to try to, you know, go into space one day.
Yeah.
And I put this petition on my website, you know, very seriously to because I was advised by NASA scientist Joseph Knuth III that if enough Americans believed I should go into space to end the UFO debate at NASA, they should send a petition in and see what happens. But, You know, I skydive at nighttime, which is probably the scariest thing I've ever done.
Is that smart to do, David?
Well, they light up the runway with a truck, you know, with the headlights on the runway. But when you jump out of the plane, you got, you know, all these chem lights on you. I did it out at Paris, California. And a lot of guys would, you know, you jump out and you're like, which are the right headlights? You know, where do you land? And that's the hard part at night. And there are some severe dangers of night skydiving. But if I can jump out of a plane at night, then I could go on a spaceship.
Next thing I want you to do for me, because I'm not going to do it, is I want you to strap a tape recorder to yourself whenever you're going to take one of your own dives. Just kind of explain to us what's happening.
As I'm falling?
As you're jumping out of the plane, as you're getting out, do you stand on the wing or do you just jump right out?
I've, grabbed onto the wing. I've jumped out. I've jumped out of helicopters. I've done high altitude. That's really scary. At Davis, California, I trained in the same pressure chamber as Chuck Yeager at Edwards Air Force Base. Very few civilians have done this, have jumped from, 25,000 feet, 30,000 feet. And I was the first one out the plane. I was so excited. I jumped out there and you just can't believe you're out there, George. You're like this little, ball floating in space and you look down and everything's so tiny. And at that altitude, you can actually free fall at 300 miles an hour. So I stood up in a vertical stand-up position and I was just, you could actually see the air mass bending around my body, just like when you jump into a lake and you can see the implosion into the lake and the water enveloping. You can actually see that with your eyes. When you hit the lower atmosphere, it's like hitting water. And when I hit the lower atmosphere, this is when you really experience inertia. My body was vibrating so violently, my helmet was almost like ripping off my head. I had to grab my helmet, grab my oxygen mask, and hold it tight. And when I finally stabilized in the lower atmosphere, my ears popped, and it was actually something that took me about a month to get over.
When you jump with your chute and you're floating, is it loud or is it dead silent?
In the beginning, if you're in an airplane, it's loud because the airplane might be doing 100 or so miles an hour when you jump out. Now, when you jump out of a helicopter, it's dead silent. It is so peaceful. I just stood out on that little arm backwards, put my arms out in the shape of a cross, and just tilted back, and what a moment of trust that was. It's like, whoa, just, you fall back, and it's just silent, silent, silent. And after about 10 seconds, the acceleration to go terminal velocity, about 120 miles per hour, the wind starts to, caress your body, and then it gets very loud. So I couldn't actually be talking on a microphone because you would just hear wind.
You would. It would be the
That's all you would hear.
During the whole thing.
But once you have that experience, it's kind of like that's good training. I mean, if you're going to be, get over that envelope of fear to go into whether it's a spiritual experience. In fact, in there are certain mystic states of consciousness that the Buddhists call bhanga, which means boundless. It's like you're in your body and all of a sudden, kaboom. It's not like you leave your body, but you go boundless. You don't actually feel your body. You merge with the universe. And it feels like you're stepping off a cliff at first. And then it becomes intensely, intensely blissful.
How often do you do these night jumps?
I only did three of them because I had to pass, I have three levels of licenses.
I'm coming up to another request.
And I don't think I would do them again.
What if you had a cell phone and we called it when you jumped?
Oh, that would be fun.
And you just, even though it'll be windy as heck, you kind of like talk your way down.
That would be hilarious. Yeah, that would be a...
So, we'll do that if you plan another night jump. We'll time it.
Well, right now I'm just getting over, in fact, just when I released Singularity, my new book on your show, 2 days later, a girl was flying out of her driveway and slammed into my girlfriend and I in our neighborhood.
Oh.
And I got a 3.5 millimeter bulging L5 and a torn annular ring. So I was on crutches.
Won't be jumping for a while.
Well, no, I'll be jumping. I'm 5 months into the healing process.
Just my luck to arrange this with you and have Tommy, my line producer, forget to make the call.
Well, we'll do it. I mean, I think this summer I'll be jumping.
That would be great radio.
It really would.
Here you go.
Now, I wanted to go back to Pythagoras because there's something
I want to say. Yeah, let's do that, and then let's talk about From Here to Andromeda.
And Pythagoras is in From Here to Andromeda. But what I like about him is that he's an iconic mathematician and philosopher. He was not called schizophrenic. The whole Pythagorean school was all about how to purify your psychic vehicle so that you could travel out of body and visit masters and go to other planets. He believed even the moon and other planets were inhabited with intelligent beings, but we couldn't perceive them in our ordinary state of consciousness. And I think he learned a lot of this from Astraeus. Now, when you think about, he's so famous for nothing but the golden triangle, and which is A squared plus B squared equals the hypotenuse angle, which is C squared. And that's how we, you know, figure out the pitch on roofs when we're building houses. But you think about where Pythagoras learned about triangles, it goes back to ancient Egypt, the pyramids. And you think about who his teachers were, even going back to Babylon. And you think about, here we are in the Phoenix Lights case, and even Jeff Willis, a lot of the footage he's getting there, there are clearly, you know, these giant triangular UFOs appearing all over the place. I wonder if that was a message that was intended, that the master builders have returned. And that's a question I bring up in From Here to Andromeda. But then we go to another great mathematician, John Nash, from the movie The Beautiful Mind. He said in the book, I read the whole book, Beautiful Mind, I couldn't put it down. He said that the moment he did the math in proving invisible dimensions, that they actually existed, that's when his mind opened up and he started experiencing invisible dimensions. And that's when they, you know, said he was schizophrenic. And eventually, you know, they give him electric shock therapy, which I think did more damage to him than anything.
Absolutely.
But he said he was receiving messages from extraterrestrials in the book, and they were teaching him this stuff. So you have two great mathematicians, both icons, but, you know, one in the modern era. Would we have called Pythagoras a schizophrenic? I mean, in a modern time?
Might have.
What do we call everyone schizophrenic because they have experiences that are not in the, you know, four?
We do, or bipolar or something.
So I think that brings up a really important point, that these extraterrestrials may be teaching and picking certain individuals who have the ability to take humanity to another level in a specific area. It could be the arts, it could be in music, it could be in math, and it could be in physics. And I even wonder if Einstein himself was not receiving such messages but never disclosed it.
I'm not sure Einstein was human, David.
Exactly, and Nikola Tesla as well, you know. I really think that's what's been going on. But now you have these cases of all these children who all over the world, in fact, reported in UFO magazine. And this is something I've been following myself because there are a lot of
children. That's the cover in UFO magazine.
Yeah,
as well.
There's a lot of children that are close to me and even very young. People, in fact, my fiance Crystal's, her cousin, he has these experiences. In fact, in Santa Monica, he can see interdimensionally. In the same way, in the UFO magazine story, you have these kids in India who apparently are talking in sign language to these invisible beings that their parents and their school teachers can't see.
Yeah.
And it appears that these kids have this ability to non-intrusively, these beings can appear in these invisible dimensions, and we all know how that works now. You know, we can only see from red to violet, so maybe these kids are seeing into the ultraviolet and they're able to see them and therefore learn from them. They become their pupils. And some of these teachers are saying these children are bored in their normal classwork, but when they go into their experiences and going on these ships, they get these information or knowledge bombs dropped on their brain. Well, my fiance Crystal's cousin, Dimitri, he is a massive genius. He sees invisible beings all the time. In fact, one time he described this black, you know, the flying men in Mexico? Have you seen those videos?
Yeah, those are incredible.
They're incredible.
Bizarre.
They have these waves around them. They almost look like action heroes.
Yeah, I mean, for a while I thought they were like, you know, the old days they had the old backpacks and you'd mm-hmm. be able to...
The power packs.
Yeah, there was a... Williams Aviation used to have those things mm-hmm. and you'd be able to fly away that way. I thought maybe that was some guy with one of those, but no, I don't think so.
When you look close in the video, you can see these really fast, black, like shimmering waves around them as well.
Yeah.
And this kid, Dimitri, actually saw one land on a roof in Santa Monica, and then he described seeing this white one that was kind of angelic come down and do like Matrix-style kung fu or something really fast with it and cause it to kind of dissipate. The black one went away. And then someone in Santa Monica filmed some video. I actually saw at one of the MUFON meetings in Los Angeles, somebody got, you know, video in Santa Monica of one of the flying men. So you kind of have double confirmation there. This kid says he could see them. But then also, you know, there's some video footage of these things. So you know, these kids, in fact, Roger Weir, the great teacher who taught me about
the wonderful teacher.
You know him?
Oh, yes.
He's a brilliant, brilliant man. He teaches at the Bodhi Tree in Los Angeles every Saturday morning, and he has a two-year course. I mean, he's got a $2 million library. I mean, the man is, he really needs to have his own university. But he's the one who told me, he said, David, the new children, they're the ones that are going to change everything on this planet. There's a new group of children coming in, and the world is going to change overnight.
I think that's true.
I hope so, because that is what we need right now. We need a new level of consciousness that has the level of genius of a Nikola Tesla or an Einstein to take us to that next quantum, you know, leap. Another thing I wanted to mention is the Michael Lee Hill video over Lake Erie that Lex posted on your site about a week ago,
mm-hmm.
which is in my film From Here to Andromeda. I want to point out a couple of things, because the video has already got 100,000 views in just two short
weeks. Are you kidding me?
100,000 views. That's amazing. Now, Michael Lee Hill, there are some people who say, oh, you know, they're just airplanes. What you see in the video is about 40 to 100 feet above Lake Erie, there is this pulsing, strobing light that, you know, we're calling a UFO, hovering there. There's no noise. I've been down to Lake Erie with Michael, and I filmed down there. It's a very gentle surf there. I mean, he's saying these lights to the naked eye are about 30 to 40 yards off the shore, you know, maybe even 100 yards off the shore, which means if they were airplanes or helicopters, you would definitely hear them. Now, the problem with a lot, now, the next thing you see in the video is from the right-hand side of the frame, another UFO comes in, hovers right on top of this particular UFO. I mean, in fact, only maybe 10 or 20 feet above it. There's no way an airplane or a helicopter would hover above another one only 10 or 20 feet above it. I mean, that would be illegal under the FAA regulations, first of all, because of the vortexes you get with airplanes. There's no way they would do that unless they were stunt planes. And then hovers and holds itself on top of the one UFO, and then it backs out. Now, people are trying to say these are airplanes coming in such steep angles and producing an optical illusion. One of the things you have to appreciate is, first of all, Michael Lee Hill won the Stephen Vai Open Guitar Contest. And if anybody knows who Stephen Vai is, he's like one of the gods in the guitar world right now, him and Joe Satriani. And Stephen Vai, who we've been in touch with, I mean, to give Michael Lee Hill this title, you're basically looking at someone who's obviously intelligent, obviously has incredible manual dexterity. You could never win a guitar contest like that all over the United States unless you were really a brilliant person. And I think Michael Lee Hill knows what an airplane looks like. So in the middle of the night, when, you know, you have these video cameras operating, and I have a lot of different types of cameras with different sensitivity, and even Art Bell can tell you this, because when he saw his giant, the Triangular UFO come right down over the highway in Nevada, if you shot video of that, you can't see the detail in the black like the human eye can see with these video cameras.
And what do you mean by detail?
Well, even at night, like when you go over to LAX and you stand underneath the airplanes and, you know, I videotape airplanes coming in over LAX, you can clearly see the lights in the formation, and then you can see the silhouette of the aircraft itself. The problem with a video camera is it can't really see that very well. I mean, sometimes you can get a little bit of shape there on the black or the dark edges in the surface of the actual.
And you definitely can't see texture.
And you definitely can't see texture. So I think, you know, if these things are as close as Michael Lee Hill is saying, and if they were airplanes, I think he would know. And then you have to think about, okay, here's another thing about the Lake Erie sightings. Michael and I went on the Mike Trevisano show, and they got, you know, so many calls, 911 calls on certain cases where there were mass UFO sightings over Lake Erie, that I have to say that, you know, some of these people who think these things are, people are videotaping airplanes and throwing hoaxes, how would so many people call 911 who don't know what an airplane is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we have this police officer on videotape who shows us all of his World War II medals. And while he was a police officer stationed in Ohio, he got a bulletin posted at his station that said that all UFO reportings are sightings are to be reported to such and such a, you know,
agency,
which would mean the military is aware that there's something,
and they're
going
trying to
on.
Take control of it.
And then you go from Lake Erie, and Michael Lee Hill's been videotaping UFOs over Lake Erie long before the O'Hare incident. And then you think, well, that's another Great Lake sighting, right? You know, O'Hare is just right off the Great Lake. And I think there's something going on in that area. That's another hotspot right now. Daytime sightings are easier to confirm. I mean, there's no there's no doubt when you're looking at videotape of a night sighting, but you have to consider the eyewitnesses in tandem with the actual footage and really, really take a closer look. Also, if you look at the FAA blinking lights that are mandatory on all civilian and military aircraft, they pulse very fast. They have a really fast strobe rate. And if you look at the lights in the videotape, they're pulsing really slowly in a kind of a much bigger bulbous kind of a light than the FAA light. The FAA lights are very small, and they're very fast.
You know, David, this all tells you again, though, that there's something strange going on.
Yeah, there really is. I mean, I think we're talking about possibly invading Iran, and you think about what's happening in the world. I have something also very shocking about the space shuttle disaster, the most recent one we had a few years ago, that will be in my film. In fact, it's hard to talk about because it's so shocking when you look at the actual photographs themselves. And I think
all right, now these aren't those strange animated photos that people think are real, right?
Well, there's
you know which ones I'm talking about?
Yeah, well, there's the photographs that were taken in San Francisco showing a purple corkscrewing wave striking
right,
the shuttle.
Right, right. That's a real photo.
But people have animated those photos and turned them into a little QuickTime movie. Now,
no, I'm talking about the one where there's this horrible graphic-looking series of pictures taken in space as if there was another shuttle next to the shuttle taking these pictures of it blowing up.
Oh, and, no, I haven't seen that.
No, as in those aren't real.
No, those aren't real. No, I'm not talking about
okay.
that. But so that's where we are right now, in this phenomena.
Tell me about the two websites we've got here for you. Then we're going to take the break and come back and talk about the incredible things, including where do 6.5 billion souls go?
Well, that's the spiritual question. I mean, from here to Andromeda.com, Andromeda is A-N-D-R-O-M-E-D-A. From here to Andromeda.com is my new movie coming out in April. And my website where Singularity is Lulu, LULU.com/David Sarita.
Can people email you that way if they want to?
They can get a hold of me on both of those sites, yeah.
Okay. So you make it simple for everybody.
Yeah. I get a lot of emails, and I try to answer all of them. But, you can get a hold of me through those sites.
Okay. Very good. Stay with us, David. More to talk with you about. We'll open up the phone lines in the last hour with you. But next hour, when we come right back, we'll talk about some of these incredible things here, all tied into Singularity, too, as a matter of fact, from here to Andromeda. That is his latest work. David Sarita is our guest. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David, the movie out in April. Now, is this going to be a DVD? Or are you going to have it on the big screen? Where's it going
to
be?
Well, I'd like to have it on the big screen. We're shooting it in high definition. It's the most beautiful film I've
gorgeous.
Ever shot.
It is gorgeous.
And one of the things we're doing here, I mean, From Here to Andromeda is about the end of life on Earth, mass extinction from global warming. When we see Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth, the last four ice ages were preceded by great CO2 warming trends. And our current warming trend outshines, I mean, it stands way above the last four ice ages, the warming trends that preceded the last four ice ages. So it looks like we are heading towards an iconoclasm. We are heading towards a possible mass extinction. And whether that means global warming produces an ice age or a massive outbreak, a virus outbreak.
Right.
Or, you mentioned all these bees dying. In fact, I even do a scene on that in this new movie about just the sensitivity of my fiance. When she was driving through this field of butterflies, she started crying, and we had to pull the car over and actually take a closer look at them. And when you really think of these little things, bees and butterflies, I mean, butterflies have been around for 130 million years.
That's right.
They survived the dinosaurs. They survived all the mass extinctions. And what's interesting about them is without them, we can't live because they pollinate all of our foods.
That's right. That's what our entomologists were telling us the first hour.
So we look at you're saying all these bees are dying. I mean, we should be more alarmed about that than anything in global warming because, again, without them, we have no food, and no food, we die. And you wonder, you know, why these things are occurring. And then we also, in the film, we look at how will we actually, for those human beings who want to live sustainably, who actually love this planet and respect it, where can we go next if we want to go to another planet? Well, so that's why we start investigating the UFO phenomena, and we look for, you know, are we going to get picked up? Is there going to be a rapture? Is there going to be a teleportation of mass souls to another planet? Or are we going to be teleported off the planet and sequestered until, you know, the mass extinctions, you know, are finished and they bring human life back down onto the planet, very similar to the story of Noah and Gilgamesh, I mean, these tales. Or, you know, are we going to have to find our own way? And one of the things, I don't like to rely on the idea that someone is going to save us. I really believe we have to save ourselves. We have to find our own way to a new home. But then we also start asking the spiritual question, religiously or even non-religiously. If you consider there's 6.5 billion of us living here as souls in these human bodies, and we have this attitude that only less than 1% of us are willing or have the ability to live sustainably due to certain oppressions or repressions inside of ourselves, the question is, who else would want us? You know, are we behaving like a virus? Are there guardian angels on other planets who, because they have beautiful paradise planets, they wouldn't let us in? The question becomes, what happens to an exodus of 6.5 billion souls if we destroy this place? So we actually traveled to New York, and we got an interview with Professor Robert Thurman, who translated the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and is the Dalai Lama's, you know, one of his number one scholars in America. And we asked him the question, that actual question. And, you know, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which I've scoured and studied, basically what...
And I've also read the Egyptian book.
Me too. Yeah, I read that years ago.
Yeah.
Very different. Very different. Look, they seem to have more of a view on, you know, the great leaders having access to the higher heavens and the, you know, the peasants and the workers basically don't have much of a chance. But in Tibetan Buddhism, basically when we die, we approach this supernatural clear light of the enlightened realms, which is one step beyond the pleasure or paradise realms of the heavens. And what happens is most of us fear it because we're spiritually unable to withstand the levels of ecstasy and enlightenment because it's too powerful. So we fear it and we seek reincarnation. That's what the Buddhists, to them it's not a belief. To them they have mapped like an astronaut. Thurman coins the term psychonauts. They have actually mapped the cosmos in the in-between realms. And this is what actually happens. So I'm thinking, okay, in Tibetan Buddhism, everyone is going to be, most of the souls seek reincarnation back in their Earth-like school, but it's not there anymore. It's kind of like a Got Milk commercial, you know, got a body? No, there's no more left. So according to Tibet, when I was in India studying with the Dalai Lama in 1996, he's basically telling us where all the souls go in the different compartmental realms they go, very similar to Catholicism or Christianity or Hinduism. They all have the basic same ideas. The only difference is in Tibetan Buddhism, hell realms are not permanent. People only go there for as long as they need to work out that negative karma, and then it expires. So if you really think about that, where else would we go? So we asked Thurman that question first. And his answer is quite shocking to me because he kind of laughs and he comes from this place of compassion and abundance. And he says there's billions and billions of other planets out there. And I said, are there other organic planets? I mean, NASA hasn't been able to see, you know, where these planets are that can sustain human life. And he says, oh, yes. I mean, there, in the Buddhist cosmology, there are billions and billions of other planets. And there's so much abundance out there that, yeah, we'll find a new place to go. But he said, eventually we will seek reincarnation in a realm very much like Earth. And, you know, that may be, you know, because the Earth isn't here anymore or it can't sustain life for perhaps another 10,000 years until it recycles itself. Maybe we'll be in a bit of a bind. But it's really amazing to see him come from this perspective. And then, you know, the real thing is, you know, where are these planets and how do these Buddhas and these great beings traverse the great distances in the universe? So I started to ask him the UFO question from the Tibetan point of view. And at first he kind of ignored the question. And much later into the interview, he said, actually, they do have something that deals with this subject. But from their perspective, these great masters travel through these multiple millions of universes through spacecraft that are enveloped around the master's body. They are not machines. They're actually, he describes these towers, and he names the sutra, where these giant towers.
Is it energy?
They're energy manifestations that are like, it's almost like they have to cloak their spiritual body with an architecture in order to traverse the multiple universes. So that could explain part of the wave phenomena around, you know, even the flying men and some of the flying men phenomena, but also possibly around some of these UFOs. And then he said that there are sutras where they describe these craft as being made of flower petals. And flower petals could be just a metaphor for something really beautiful and kind of swirly. Because, you know, these are, you're talking about sutras that were written, you know, in the 6th century AD, Tibetan Buddhism. And Buddha exists 623 BC. So, you know, these are very old scriptures. And, you know, they didn't have light bulbs back then. I mean, they used the metaphor fire for light.
At least we don't think they did.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and then you look at the Egyptians and you think maybe they really did have electricity. So then we go much further in the interview. We start talking about invisible cities. In Buddhism, there are several names for different cities that are actually on the earth that are like parallel dimensions to our own planet that we can't see. And until we, according to Buddha, we actually attain higher levels of consciousness that ultimately culminate in permanent enlightenment, which is nirvana. In fact, you don't have to fully attain, you know, full Buddhahood to actually see some of these realms. Apparently, there are cities on our planet that are interdimensional, and I cited Shambhala, which some people know as Shangri-La. And Thurman looked at me.
Saw an old movie about that a long time ago.
Yeah, and Thurman looked at me and he said, Shambhala is not a city. He said, it's a country. It's a whole country. And there are many Tibetan masters who have actually been there. And he said it's sort of, quote, it's in another dimension of Earth, but you can actually go there. It's a real place. It's not a place in your mind, but it's actually here on the planet. So as we got further and further into that, he revealed that there is a prophecy, and he's had conversations with the Dalai Lama about this, that Shambhala will interdimensionally appear to all of us. It will become visible to everyone, and they have a certain date when this is going to happen in their prophecy, and they're estimating it to be 300 years from now. And when this country emerges, which is in the northern regions of our planet, our militaries will gather strength and try to make war against them, and we lose, because very much like Qi masters, they have this power of the mirror in their prophecy, which means if we send a missile at them, the missile just mirrors back at us and destroys us. It's kind of like, you know, these Tai Chi masters, if you send them a negative thought, the negative thought takes you down. The Qi master is untouchable. So all the beings in Shambhala have this power, and once we lose the war, it marks a new... If you think about this, because how this parallels the Christian story of the Revelation, how there's a new heaven and a new earth, and in a way that's what this is. This is a new heaven actually interfaces with earth, and earth becomes a paradise. And according to the Tibetans, this period of peace will last 1,800 years. This is what Thurman was saying. But then he said, wait a minute. He was arguing with the Dalai Lama. He said, if this is in 300 years, he said, we're not going to be here in 300 years. And this is all in the movie From Here to Andromeda, by the way. So Thurman's saying, well, the prophecy must be a lot sooner than that because we're getting close to the end right now. So he's kind of debating about how accurate their time, you know, scale is. But what's interesting about this myth in Tibetan Buddhism is that it's so similar to the Christian story, once again, of the Revelation, that at the end of this great war, you know, the Battle of Armageddon, you have this massive judgment period, and then you have the new era of peace, that there's 1,000 years of peace according to the end of the Revelation, and then you have a new heaven and a new earth. So you think about what that means. If earth goes into a higher dimension of energy, these invisible dimensions may suddenly overlap, and suddenly you're able to perceive them. And this is where we go back to Pythagoras once again, and it all comes crashing together, that maybe once again, in my book Singularity, because of the duality code, because we're in this state of internal conflict, and this conflict produces these three levels of inertia, the first that we age and we experience death, and the second that
Let's explain each one.
Yeah, each one briefly. The very fact that we took in the knowledge of good and evil, which was forbidden in the Garden of Eden,
mm-hmm.
which I document that the real interpretation of that is that it's not a good thing that we knew good and evil, it's actually the cause of our fall, because we originally started in a state of singularity, in a state of love, in a state of union. In fact, here we are speaking on this great day of love. When in singularity, imagine a state of love is a state of peace and union and bliss where there's no conflict. But as soon as you ingest conflict, the knowledge of good and evil, a conflict can't exist in a vibrational field of love, so it falls. God doesn't kick us out of paradise. We decide to go into conflict. We believe in it, so we ingested it. So now we become the conflict, and because we become the conflict, we are no longer in paradise. We individually, egotistically interpret the knowledge of good and evil individually, and because we do that egoically, all of our interpretations are different, and this causes us to argue and fight with one another, alienate each other from our love because we are seeing things so differently, and we divide our politics, we divide our religions. A single religion becomes divided hundreds of times. All of the great religions have hundreds of divisions. Then there's infighting inside the religion and separations and even killing. And eventually we go to war with each other. So this is, you know, this is all documented in our previous discussions on the first level of inertia. The first level of inertia is war, psychological warfare, and that the very fact that this conflict is inside of us causes us to waste all of our psychic energy, all of our spiritual energy.
Does it drain or waste or both?
Well, it drains. Imagine, you know, positive and negative fighting inside of you, inside of every
tearing
one of
you
us.
Apart.
It tears you apart and it exhausts your reservoir. So psychically, we only have this tiny difference between the positive and negative. You have a little bit of leftover energy because they don't cancel each other out entirely. And that tiny bit of energy is all we have to perceive our universe around us, which is what I believe causes us to only be able to see from red to violet wavelengths of light to only hear from 20 to 20,000 hertz. It puts us in this little narrow sliver of reality. So what happens is when the earth goes into, when we go into a higher level of spirituality, when we start to vibrate with more and more peace and more love for all beings, and we end this internal conflict inside of us, when Jesus says in Matthew 6:22, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, which really internally means if we end the conflict inside of ourselves, the duality of good and evil, we become single, we become one. And in that state of oneness, we start to vibrate in a higher frequency. We suddenly have more energy to perceive the invisible universe around us. And that's where I believe Pythagoras was able to see that all of the planets have life on them. And this code, this what I call the duality code, which causes these three great inertias, is actually preventing us from seeing that we're not alone in the universe, that there's life all around us, and that Shambhala and the other invisible cities in other cultures, there are invisible cities in native Indian folklore, there's many invisible cities in Hinduism, and there's, in fact, in Buddhism, the father of Tibetan Buddhism lives in an invisible Copper Mountain paradise. And there are a number of those paradises on the planet. So our planet may have all these invisible countries and cities that we don't see. And so the question is, are some of these UFOs actually interdimensionally jumping from those, from the singularity, from the real universe, what I believe is the real-time universe, which I can actually prove?
Well, that's possible. What about these, and you've heard shadow people on this program before, what if they are passing through these interdimensions?
I think so. You know, I've had personally a lot of experiences with seeing interdimensional beings with my eyes open. You know, it's something that started after, you know, I had this in 1994, I had this massive appearance with, you know, this supremely enlightened being that I mentioned was the teacher of singularity.
And, right.
You know, I don't say his name on the air for certain reasons, but
why?
Well, do you want me to, I can say it.
No, tell me why you don't first.
Well, I just don't want to, you know, get people into a religious.
Well, you're not going to say Beelzebub, are you?
No.
I'm kidding.
I mean, I'll say his name if
it's okay. Say his first name, sure.
Well, in 1994, when I was bankrupt and destitute, my Green and Blue Corporation raising money for EcoVenture Capital went bankrupt. I went tree planting that summer and was, at the end of tree planting, I basically got fined for back taxes and the government took all my money away. I had nowhere to live. I pitched a tent in my father's ranch in Topanga Canyon, and I was really devastated just over the fact that I couldn't raise any money for these brilliant environmental technologies, nuclear helium-3 fusion, hydrogen fuel cell breakthroughs, and this is back in the,
You had great ideas, but
the 1990s. I mean, yeah. This is way before Al Gore's movie was out.
Yeah.
And what happened was there I'm living in a tent with no money, nowhere to go. My dad was rebuilding his house that was under construction. There was nowhere for me to stay. And a rainstorm came. If you remember 94, we had massive, they were like monsoons in 94. And my little tent was flooded, and I started to get hypothermic. And I left my body, and I had no desire to go into the house and get warm.
Mm-hmm.
I just said, God, take me. Those were the words I said.
Please take me, right?
And please take me. And at this point, I had been practicing Buddhism most of my life, and, I was baptized Catholic as a baby. And all of a sudden, I float over to the oak trees, out of body, and I go, wow, I'm out of my body. And there's this giant granite crucifix. I mean, it's dark, beautiful stone, and the crucifix is like the monolith in the movie 2010. And it's got this angelic echo, this beautiful vibration. And there is a baptismal font shaped like a crucifix right beneath it. And the water just calls me to fall into the water. It's just saying, fall into me with all this love. And I fall into the water, and I'm suddenly, all my emotional pain, all of my suffering is gone. And at that moment, just to have my emotional pain taken away was a miracle. And all of a sudden, like a mother carrying a baby in her arms, I was pulled above the rain clouds. I could see the sun hadn't yet risen on the horizon. And I thought, oh, my God, you're dead, David. You froze to death. And all of a sudden, millions of tiny little atoms of light, billions of them, came from below, above, beneath, every direction in the universe. And these little atoms were so bright. It was like millions of diamonds. They came rushing together and instantaneously materialized the body of Jesus Christ in front of me. And in 1 second, he was billions of suns in brightness. I fell on my face. I could barely look at him, and I fell on the ground and went, oh, my God. I looked at him, and there was so much love and ecstasy, I couldn't bear to look at it. And that was the beginning of me receiving messages about singularity. He actually started to talk to me as I was falling at his feet, looking up at him intermittently, being blinded by his light. And I went, I couldn't believe who I was in the presence of. I mean, it was...
Like he changed your whole life.
Changed my whole life. Yeah.
Stay with us, David. Much more to talk with you about. I want to talk about SETI when we come back as well. Search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. David, before we get into SETI, I wanted you to finish up on your thoughts about that visitation that obviously changed your life forever.
Well, it completely changed my life, George, because I had been meditating for many years at that point. I was 1994, I'm 45 now. I think I was 33 when that happened. And I actually had three visits with Jesus. The second was Easter morning, 1997, and I reported to, the Catholic Church in Malibu there, and I met with a father there.
Did he believe you, or what did he say?
He really did. He believed me. He didn't want me to go public with it, but he started speaking to me and teaching me singularity, which I eventually had to prove in physics and prove in scripture, which took years of research. And I've read every, published and unpublished manuscript in Christian mysticism there is. And I had to study and study, because Jesus would say things to me, and some of them were difficult to find copies of those things in the canonical gospels. And I started looking in the Nag Hammadi Library and the Gospel of Thomas. And in fact, there's one manuscript called the Acts of John. And this would blow Mel Gibson's mind. It was banned by Pope Leo the Great. But he actually, in one of my visitations with him, he pointed me to the Acts of John to show me that it was true. And in the Acts of John, which is such a great, true iconoclasm against our traditional understanding of the crucifixion, is that Jesus is dancing and celebrating before his arrest with the disciples, and they're the ones who are crying. he can't get them to dance. They don't want to dance because they know that they're going to torture him and kill him.
Well, so did he, right?
What's that?
He knew that, too.
He knew that, too, but he was dancing and had no fear. And then they arrest him in the Acts of John. And during his crucifixion, to make a long story short, in the Acts of John, which anyone can research on the Internet, and they were burning the Acts of John all over the Roman Empire. They didn't want any copy of it to survive. Pope Leo the Great did not want anyone to survive. And what happens is John cannot watch the suffering of Jesus because it's so graphic, just like in Mel Gibson's movie. And then he goes into the cave to weep on the Mount of Olives, and Jesus appears in the cave during the moment of his crucifixion, before he's given up the ghost. And he says, John, remember the dance that I taught you. He said, I am dancing right now, John. I'm celebrating. That's just a body on that cross. He goes, I'm not the body. I'm God. I am, you know, basically he's telling John that he's not suffering. And so what I did when I found, when Jesus pointed me to the Acts of John, is I started to look for more proof. And in Hindu mysticism and Buddhist mysticism, there are seven levels of samadhi which culminate in permanent enlightenment, which is nirvana. According to Hindu, you know, scholars and Hindu meditation masters, once you go into the higher levels of samadhi, there's no perception or non-perception of the body at all. You could stick nails through it. You could, you know, pierce it with lances. You could do anything to it. And there's the master has no perception of the suffering at all. In fact, that is consistent. In fact, one time I was watching 60 Minutes or one of these news shows, 2020, and there was this Islamic prayer going on where once these Muslims, you know, they chanted these certain scriptures, they would go into trance. And in this particular state of trance, anybody within this certain perimeter of this field, you could stick needles through them, torture them, swords right through their arms, and they didn't feel any pain.
No pain, yeah.
And this news anchor actually ran a needle right through the center of his palm, and he didn't feel any pain. And you think about that. If in the Hindu, you know, experience of enlightenment and the Buddhist experience, if there's no suffering at all at that level of enlightenment, the question is, did Jesus physically suffer on the cross? Now, he suffered in a way because he suffered for our sins. He's weeping for our ignorance, for the fact that we keep hurting each other. The very fact that the Romans and his persecutors treated him like that, he weeps inside for humanity. So that wound is still there, but the physical perception of suffering is not really there. It's only there because that organism, that body is suffering.
Well, let's bring this back then to the singularity of all this.
Well, it brings us back to singularity because if you look at the true cause of suffering, what pain is, pain is born out of conflict. As soon as you go from a state of total singularity and oneness and you introduce conflict, conflict produces inertia, friction, heat, which gives rise to pain in the actual organism itself. So when you end, you know, in fact, in the Gospel of Thomas, the very first verse, Jesus is saying that he who understands these things will not he says, whoever discovers the interpretation of these things will not taste death. I mean, I think that saying is so supported in the rest of the scripture here that he literally means you won't taste death. You won't even feel pain. He's actually telling you that right
there.
Well,
you believe we are trapped, though, in some kind of matrix, right?
I think the knowledge of good and evil, which, again, was traditionally interpreted as meaning that it was a good thing in the end that we took it in, although if we really understand that God warned us never to take it in or we will die, what happens is it binds us in a state of conflict. It exhausts all of our psychic and spiritual energy. It causes us to separate or alienate us from each other. For example, even Christianity is divided hundreds of times, and we, you know, Protestants and, you know, say the Catholics are going to go to hell because they got it all wrong and vice versa. And you have the Sinn Féin and the bombings in Ireland. You have, you know, the wars between all the different fractions of Christianity. And then you have these three great religions that all have the same God in common, basically fighting in the Middle East, you know, the at each other's throats. And really what's happened is this knowledge of good and evil is so poisonous, it has caused us to put up the walls, caused us to go to war, caused us to spend. Just look at the financial equation of war. Just look at how much energy is there in a state of oneness financially if we weren't in a state of war with each other. But the very fact that we're at war with each other, we cancel out all of our finances. I mean, all of our greatest resources, all the billions of dollars we spend on going to war and protecting our country from terrorism.
Well, yeah, but that's because, and I, you know, we're going off the wrong path here, David, but that's because those people who promote war are making money on it in a different way, and they're not too interested on spending the money on these other things that could lead this planet, you know, into another, basically, push into the universe.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I think, but they're also afraid to be so vulnerable. I mean, when the Cold War ended the first time, and we're possibly now going into another Cold War if we look at the headlines, there was a sense of vulnerability. I mean, Clinton was shutting down military bases all over the country. We were coming to a new era of peace. We didn't have an enemy. And I think to be a truly peaceful country...
Well, one could also say he weakened us.
Yeah, exactly. That was their perception. And there's a certain point there where you almost think we were so afraid of being so weak and peaceful that we almost wanted an enemy.
See, so I've always believed the strongest person on the block doesn't have to fight.
Yeah.
You can be a patrol officer.
But think of how much money we would have if we attained singularity true peace.
Oh, I agree, but they'd probably waste it on something else.
They'd probably waste it on something else.
Yeah, they won't spend it on the things that need to be spent.
I mean, here we are. This is the irony in From Here to Andromeda. When CNN, September 1st, the headlines were, "If we destroy this planet, will science find us a new one?" When I read those headlines, I put it in the film and I thought, my God, are we really willing to go that far that we're not willing to change our policies? We'd rather go look for another planet.
Yeah, buy a new house. Let's not clean up the house we own. Let's not repair it. Let's just go buy a new house.
But we don't even know how to get to another house, another star system.
No, and we won't for a long,
no,
long
so we're,
time.
We're really willing to risk all that because we don't want to make a... In fact, I was interviewing Professor David Phillips at Santa Monica College, and David Phillips has a PhD in psychology and environmental sciences, and he's saying we need a Manhattan-style project to do an emergency transformation of the planet to sustainability if we're going to survive, if we're going to make this 5 to 10 year window that we have to reverse the damage we've already done. And if we don't make that window, 10 years from now, maybe too late, even if we go 50% sustainable. And I asked a high executive at Ontario Hydro in Canada, I said, if we even attain the Kyoto Protocol, do you think we're going to beat global warming? And he said, no.
See, you're a believer in that. I'm a believer that we're in a cycle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in an Earth cycle. As I got to tell you, a lot of scientists are beginning to open up their mouths. They were petrified to say anything about it before, but they're beginning to say the same thing. But
it just takes one scientist. It takes one Tesla. I mean, when Edison invented the light bulb and Tesla redid light bulbs, it changed the world for everybody. Now we can all read in the dark.
You talk about, because I wanted to ask you this before we get to the top of the hour. You talk about SETI, that, you know, they're spending money. They're trying to get electronic messages using their radio telescopes. They can't seem to do it yet. You know, they're going to have this Paul Allen array of telescopes online soon. I hope it works. I'm not sure. You don't seem to think it's going to work.
Well, one of the things we can prove with singularity is that because we know that radio waves and light, you know, which is all the same thing, electromagnetism travels at the speed of light, it doesn't travel instantaneously the way singularity does. And we can't imagine that, you know, when you look at the separation in distances between star systems and galaxies, Andromeda's 2.2 million years from here. If you're sending a radio wave from Andromeda, it takes 2 million years to get here. There's no way they're communicating through radio. They couldn't do it effectively because it takes too long to send the message, and then the message, you know, as a waveform, collides with other waves, and you get distortion. It will never get here. So the point is, now that we know singularity is real, it exists. Einstein's spooky action at a distance has proved it. The Elaine aspect experiment proved it, which we've talked about before. So now I'm devising an experiment to actually send the human voice through the singularity, and I actually know how to do this. It's actually really simple. It's so simple when I show, you know, scientists, you know, how it actually works. If I could show SETI, if I could get Seth Shostak's ear to look at this, to look at the Elaine aspect experiment, if there's a key in that experiment – which, you know, to recap, essentially, Alain Aspect, the French physicist, in 1993, he separated an electron-anti-electron pair, which essentially is a duality. But when he separates the positron from the negative electron, and he separates the two of them, they become mini singularities, but they're in a relationship with one another. And what he did was, when he altered the wave functions of one, the other one responded instantaneously, not at the speed of light. So that means that there is a way to send information through the singularity between one point in the singularity and another. The question is now, can you send a message through it, the human voice? And I want to do an experiment and send my fiance Crystal's jazz song, one of her jazz songs, through the singularity to see if you get an answer. And I believe there are certain experiments that have already been done that have inadvertently or accidentally stumbled upon this. Now, once we can use the singularity as a tool, not only will we be able to see the first real-time picture of our universe and possibly our own world, but we may actually get an answer from another intelligent civilization. But there's no way in the world I can accept that the radio signals are going to yield any positive results. They haven't for decades now, and I don't think they're ever going to get anything out of it. So I think we have to start looking. You know, when people read singularity, they'll see very clearly why this is a valid option, why we can actually start accessing this. But what it's going to mean is when we start receiving messages, just like in white noise, you can actually hear the very faded voices of the dead or deceased or disembodied spirits. When we access the singularity, I think we're going to start to see that there's a real-time universe that really knows how to communicate over any distance in zero time, and I think that's what they're using. But there's a way to transpose radio signals. For example, this is a really amazing conundrum. The human voice sound only travels at roughly 750 miles an hour. But you can actually get sound to break the speed of sound. And the way you do it is you entangle the human voice as a waveform onto a radio wave. So sound then wraps itself around a radio wave, travels at the speed of light. It's like kind of like getting on a train, and then you get off as a receiver, and all of a sudden you've obviated the problem. You've got the human voice to travel at the speed of light. You see?
Sure.
It's the same way. One day we will be able to take the human voice and put it on the singularity and send a message through it and go, we're here. Is there anybody out there? Or you can possibly, you know, send a singularity message to Andromeda and see if something comes back from the singularity. And the message could come back very quickly. You know, I think we're going to start to see that there is a much more viable way to communicate with extraterrestrial life. Singularity will eventually make wormholes obsolete as a mode of transportation.
How close are we to really doing this?
Well, I think I've actually heard some rumors. When I was lecturing at the Conscious Life Expo in L.A., I mentioned that I wanted to do this experiment, sending the human voice through the singularity. And when I told, you know, one of the people who came to my lecture how I was going to do it, they said that Alain Aspect, and they figured out the same thing I did, how to do it. And it's really simple. So I think they're going to be onto this. I think the world is going to be onto this. And it's just going to open up a whole new level of our understanding of the universe. And all of it, you know, the whole journey of singularity for me started with those three visitations with Jesus Christ. And he teaches me and points me to Scripture. And then eventually I merge Scripture with quantum physics.
With science.
We now have the merging of the two in the field of singularity.
How many invisible dimensions do you think there are on this planet?
I think if you look at the work of Richard Feynman, there are probably millions of parallel histories that are real, what he called the sum of history, sum over history, that every possibility for Earth's existence and every human being's individual lives actually exists. We only experience the one we choose. Now, possibly schizophrenics are able to see two of those possibilities at the same time. But the singularity is yet another thing. It's something even beyond that. So I think what happens is, it's kind of like this. Imagine two fish under the Atlantic Ocean, and they want to go from New York to London. And when the fish are going through the water, they realize that you got to push your tail so hard to go through the water, and the water produces so much inertia, so much weight pushing you back, and it just exhausts you. And one of the fish goes, well, you know, if you get out of the water and you travel through the air on these on aircraft, you can cross the Atlantic with way less energy. It's way easier. You just float through the air. What happens is the finer and finer strata that you move through, the less inertia you encounter. When you find out that when you get out of air mass, I mean, inside of the air mass, we can do, like the X-15 was doing Mach, you know, 8, apparently.
Right.
Now, when you get out of the air mass, the space shuttle can do 18,000 miles an hour, you know, flying around the Earth, and it can go even faster than that. We have satellites that do 30, 40,000 miles an hour. Now, according to Einstein, in space, which is not a true void, but is a, you know, not a true vacuum, but is somewhat of a void, space is a fabric also. It's just a much more finer fabric than air mass is. You still can't go faster than the speed of light when you move through space. So when you think of these UFOs, when they go invisible, like the one I saw in Berkeley, after 20 minutes it goes invisible, what they figured out is you can't move through space because it's too heavy. It's going to eventually push on you, especially when you approach the speed of light. It's going to crush you. And then you can't turn at those velocities to avoid incoming debris because the G-forces on the turns will kill you if you have mass. But if you get out of space, you see what I mean? It's like the fish getting out of the water, and you go to the next lower, the next strata, which has even less inertia than the fabric of space, you can move even faster. How many of those strata there are, oh my God, I think they ultimately culminate in singularity, which is an infinite zero point. You never really reach absolute zero singularity. It's infinite. But the higher you evolve spiritually and technologically, the more of those strata you can jump through to get to lower and lower inertial fields, meaning strata that you can move through with less inertia, meaning it takes less and less energy to move through those strata. What's interesting, what Paul Dirac discovered in the quantum level in the singularity, is that if you're in a state of conflict, the singularity rejects you. It only accepts you if you become one. As soon as you
have
conflict,
does it have a brain behind it?
I think it has intelligence behind it. So it won't accept you if you're in a state of conflict. So this way the universe protects itself from conflict spreading all over the universe. It can only be sequestered in these little locations. In the Apocryphon of John, when Jesus tells
hold
John...
Hold on. We got to take this break. We'll be back. Before we go to calls, David Sirita, tell us a little bit more about Robert Thurman discussing with you these invisible cities that are apparently all over the planet. They've always been here, I assume. How did they develop?
Well, you know, I think, like I said, in singularity, and just like the experiences of Pythagoras, these cities may have always been there. And because in physics we can't, we are not living in the real-time universe because the speed of light with which we rely for Einstein's relativity to measure all events travels too slowly. It's not instantaneous. It prevents us from seeing things right now. And what happens is, when you, according to Robert Thurman, is that there are experiences where Buddha will just put his foot down on the ground and he can cause his students, his practitioners who have been practicing meditation, to see instantaneously these invisible levels of our Earth. And that those levels have always been here. It's possible this Earth, you know, the Earth is about 4 billion years old. I mean, they may be, they, these realms may have been around much longer than the physical organic, you know, humanity. So I think what happened is when the knowledge of good and evil caused us to go into a lower dimension of our own Earth, these higher dimensions became invisible to us. And even if you look at James Redfield's the Celestine Prophecy and his visions of Shambhala and the possibility of the civilization at Machu Picchu going to a higher dimension and they can't find the skeletal remains of the people who live there, it's possible that our worlds are overlapping in a kind of parallel universe way, and they have been for millennia.
No.
And I think we're just going to realize that. We're just going to start seeing that. And when we get to that state, imagine this. Imagine if internally each individual can end the internal conflict or even 25% of their continuous state of conflict that they experience in their own psyche, how much more energy they will have psychically to perceive. I've already experienced this. I've been meditating for 25 years. I see invisible dimensions and invisible beings on a fairly regular basis. And I see them with perfect clarity with my eyes open. I've seen many different types of beings right in front of me. And the only way to convince somebody else that this is really real is, you know, have them meditate long enough and eventually it'll start happening to them too. And, you know, I saw my aunt after she died right in front of me. She looked 24 years old again, glowing with, you know, violet strip of light around her body. And when I looked at the violet strip around her body, I thought, oh, my God. I mean, years later, I figured out that's the ultraviolet. I'm seeing a color that is not normally visible to the human eye. In fact, there's an amazing book called Blue. I urge everybody to read it. You can get it on Amazon. It's by Michelle Pastoureau, I think is the name. And the book documents the history of the color blue, which the authors don't even believe that Romans could perceive. In fact, the royal color in the Roman Empire was red and black. Those were the royal colors. And eventually, as they document, blue emerges on the scene. It was originally the color of evil. It was the color of the dark forces. Now, notice today, you know, when we symbolize with colors, we use red and black as the colors of death and, you know,
sure,
destruction and the devil, and blue is now the royal color. So what they're saying in this book, Blue, which is, you know, fantastic read, that the human brain is evolving. And if you look at how many angstroms, which are wavelengths, exist just in the ultraviolet near. Ultraviolet is divided into three categories: ultraviolet near, ultraviolet far, and ultraviolet extreme. Each one of those is wider in bandwidth in angstrom units or wavelengths as the entire spectrum from red to violet that we see. So ultraviolet near is like a whole other dimension. And then there's ultraviolet far and ultraviolet extreme. NASA has video cameras that can see into the near and the far ultraviolet. So that means somewhere in there, these experiences may be, you know, these perceptions may be, you know, manifesting in those, like ultraviolet photons are, there's more of them per second, so they can reflect off of much more finer dimensions, much more subtler dimensions. So I think when I was looking at my Aunt Patsy, who was actually my stepbrother's true blood aunt and my step aunt at the time, she was actually at a Buddhist retreat in San Francisco. She was in her, I think, her early 60s, early or late 60s, and she just had a brain aneurysm and dropped dead. I didn't even know she died. I just felt a woman touching my foot in the middle of the night. I was at my writing partner's house in Redondo Beach, you know. We were crash course writing this Tesla movie script back in the 1980s. This was 1986. And all of a sudden, I feel this woman touching my leg. And I get up, and there's this girl with long brown hair, beautiful, in a white robe with this violet light around her. Her feet are floating off the floor. And I my heart was just pounding out of my chest. In fact, it was the first ghost or interdimensional I ever saw in my life. And I saw her with such perfection and such clarity. It wasn't blurry like it is in the movies. You couldn't see through her clothing. And she looked really confused. And I thought, oh, my God, she looks familiar. And then all of a sudden, the next day, and in fact, before I go to the next day, I got so scared. And she wouldn't go away. It's not one of those mirages that kind of just shimmers away. She was there. I felt her hand touching my leg. She had substance. And I just said telepathically, I said, I'm too scared, please leave. And she just got up, turned around, and floated right through the fireplace wall. And I just had goosebumps. I stayed up all night, and I asked my writing partner's wife the next morning, I said, did anybody die in your family recently? And then all of a sudden, my mom called the next day, and she said,
she told you what happened.
She told me what happened. Yeah. Then I looked at pictures of Patsy when she was young, and I go, oh, my God, that's exactly what I saw.
That's something. We got a full bank of calls for you here, David.
Okay.
Let's go to them. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. This is Blair in Sedona,
hey, Blair.
Arizona.
Blair.
Sure.
Hi, David.
Blair, you're a miracle man.
Well, I love what you're talking about, the real-time universe. When you said that, it struck a chord. Through this program 10 years ago, I learned a lot about the topography of time through Art's interview with Terrence McKenna.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, and I'm wondering if your timing is right on. You know, while we worked in the West on manipulation of matter, it was 4,000 years ago through the I Ching, the Chinese map, the topography of time.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a thing of habit and novelty, and this is like an ebb and flow, and right now we might be on the ebb of novelty, self-metamorphosis, self-revelation, tachyon bombardment, you name it. So do you think that your singularity is right on course with this topography of time?
Well, when you go from the point of the Big Bang, I think it was Stephen Hawking and Alan Guth said no one has ever explained the moment just before the Big Bang. We can only measure from the first hundred thousandths of a second on. And when you see, you go from the point of singularity, which solves the riddle, where there's no duality, and there's time has a value of absolute zero in singularity. Mass has a value of absolute zero, and energy, of course, has a value of absolute zero in all of our dimensions, X, Y, Z, and time have values of zero. Now, as soon as you have duality, you have conflict energetically in the physical universe, so therefore you have resistance, inertia, so you get from an infinitum of energy potential in the singularity, a massive amount of duality forms. You get this enormous explosion from the first two dual waves forming. And then you get all these other little waves rippling off of the collision of the first two waves, and you get this enormous temperature, which explains the moment of the Big Bang. But then you get inertia, which means resistance. So time starts to be born out of duality. In fact, inertia and time are really clearly linked to each other, and this fabric gets more and more dense, and so therefore time value starts to increase as the Big Bang, you know, unfolds, and the strata, these physical dualities, the actual layers of the cosmos start to form, and they get thicker and thicker and thicker, and those are the strata that you try to move through, and as you move through them, they push up against you, and they increase your mass, so therefore they imprison you. So time, from the point of singularity, there is no time. Time has a value of zero, and there's no aging, because atomic structures in the singularity in the spiritual universe don't age because they don't experience any conflict or inertia. So they're constantly in a state of perfection. So when you go from singularity to duality, you're giving birth to death, and time starts to grow. So from the perspective of singularity, the universe only appears to be expanding because in reverse, if you can actually understand this, the more duality forms, the more inertia forms, the more the universe slows down, time value starts increasing, which gives the observer the illusion that the universe is expanding. It actually always was infinite. It's not expanding into an infinity, it always was an infinite, and it never had a beginning or an end. But as soon as as soon as time value starts to increase, it only appears that way. So,
yeah. George, could I have a follow-up?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Well, if we're in this duality, why don't we just work with it? Obviously, you know we are. And I had an interview session back in 1976 when I lived in San Francisco. I heard Mary Bailey, and she was Alice Bailey's sister. And she talked about the Ray Energies, you know, the Master DK books at the turn of the last century. And she said our human family is now bathed in a Ray Energy that she terms harmony through conflict.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So this is something that's sort of amazing. Now, if we look at it from that way, we sort of surrender to that and work through it. We understand that this is a gigantic classroom, and this is an issue of great learning and great importance for the entire 6.5 billion souls of the human family to learn at this time if we just open up to it.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I mean, we're all starting to see this knowledge come to us. I mean, Roger Weir tells me that it's not the duality that causes the problem. It's actually a beautiful thing. And even birth, old age, and death has a beauty to it. It's our attachment to the duality that causes the suffering. And that is the key. It does serve a purpose. So what Blair is saying, you have the duality, but now once you have the singularity integrating with duality, you can now be in duality, but use singularity as a tool if you want to move from here to Andromeda instantaneously, or you want to, you know, see a real-time picture of our universe. So it has, the two can exist, coexist together. But ultimately, I think duality will expire of itself, and there will be, you know, higher and higher levels of singularity.
Okay, let's go next to our international line. Your turn, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Are you speaking with me?
I think that must be you.
Oh, that's wonderful. I just love your show tonight, David. I certainly agree with everything you're saying. It just feels so right. I'm referring to the point of singularity, and you were speaking of how thought wrapped in a radio wave could be faster. I'd like to share an experience with you that I had a few years ago. I was living by myself, and Christ came many times and spoke with me, and he, on this very cold night, 20 below Fahrenheit, took me outside And he pointed, I was facing east, and there was a bright star, and I'm sorry, I don't know which one it was. And he asked me, he said, from your heart chakra, send out a love thought. So I kind of sort of opened my heart chakra up, and I sent, and I said, with the feeling, with loving a thought, I said, I love you. And that star that I was looking at, a ray came from the star, hit me on the heart chakra and said, I love you too.
That's amazing.
Isn't it? It is amazing.
See, what if you go back to our earlier shows, the experiment the scientists did with the mother and the baby rabbit, and this is how Einstein discovered spooky action at a distance, that, of course, the mother and the baby rabbit are in a state of love and union with one another, and when you separate them, the scientists separated them, and they hooked them up to EEGs, when they pinprick the baby rabbit, the mother feels it instantaneously. And that is because love is singularity. Every one of us has a mini singularity inside of us. And it's only the non-dual thought of love that can propagate instantaneously throughout the universe. It's just as this woman has experienced, that, you know, this experience she had with the star and with Jesus, she was being taught the same thing that I was, that singularity gives you an instantaneous, the ability to communicate instantaneously over the vast distances of space, and the star responds to her instantaneously. Now, apparently in the movie, The Secret Life of Plants, which I've actually seen the movie.
Yeah, there's a great book on that, too.
There, Clive Baxter did, and the book.
And Christopher Bird.
Not in the book, but in the movie, there's a famous astronomer, and I had his name at one point, and what he did is he took a telescope and he pointed it at the star system of Sirius, and he put living sprouted mustard seeds at the end of the telescopic array, put a Faraday cage around the telescope, and they hooked up an EEG signals, wires, to the sprouted mustard seeds. And when the light from Sirius struck the mustard seeds started pulsing with what appeared to be an intelligent signal.
No way.
Which would mean that a living organism rather than a dead, you know, computer, you know, circuit.
Is that hard evidence?
Astronomer's name is well known today, and I just wonder, if you are getting real-time signals from the star system of Sirius using interfacing with living tissue, why didn't anybody pursue this? Is it possible that plants and trees can, with their very substance, can communicate in real time, meaning through the singularity? And is it possible that you could even use organisms that are in states of union or love, or possibly even animals, and use them to interface with interstellar light? I mean, for example, you could take the Pleiades and you isolate the Pleiades in the telescope, and the light that comes through the array is only coming from the Pleiades, and you run that light through a living organism and see if it responds and it's communicating in real time. Now, that's fascinating. If we think about the last caller.
Why mustard seeds?
Well, anything living. I think, a friend of mine was trying to revive a lot of Clive Baxter's work. Her name is Mylise, and she had all these plants, and she was hooking them up to little electrodes, and she got her plants to play music. She would send a vibration to her plants, and the plants would, you know, through a computer MIDI system, would transform their little tiny low-amplitude signals, and she would amp them up, and they would produce sounds in her keyboards. So she wasn't playing the music. The plants were actually playing the music, which means that the plants have the ability to communicate. Now, the question is whether, if plants have something in them, which I think are what are called biophotons, which are really high-frequency, low-amplitude photons, those photons are living photons, just like the difference between the human brain wave and then you look at the aura, the human aura, which is actually probably a biophotonic energy, that maybe those are the key to interfacing with singularity and looking. If SETI wasn't just looking at dead electronic radio waves, how about looking at living light rays and seeing if you can start communicating through the singularity that
way? All right, well, stay with us. We're going to come back with final phone calls with our special guest tonight, David Cereda. You enjoy making movies, films, videos, David?
I really do. You know, I planted trees for 22 years, and I've written books. But, you know, film has evolved so much for the independent filmmaker with these new high-definition cameras and Final Cut Pro and Macintosh. Thanks to Macintosh, we can, you know, you don't have to wait for millions of dollars to make a film, you know. my executive producers in Ohio and I are making this film on a very reasonable budget, but it looks like a $1 million budget film. It really does. So, you know, people can pre-order From Here to Andromeda at fromheretowindromeda.com now to pre-order if they want. And, yeah, I mean, it's going to be really exciting to see this film come out. I mean, there's a lot of great questions. We've interviewed so many different interesting people and professors and musicians and you know, really getting a great perspective on where we are in humanity now and where we're going and if we'll survive. And we can't rely on our, you know, our icons in our world, the big oil companies, the big corporations, to take us to this point of sustainability. We have to rely on ourselves. We have so much ingenious ability, so many geniuses in America, so many great scientists I've met who are just underfunded and have amazing breakthrough technologies like the World's Nest team and Michael Fulton and Robert Poor. There are so many great technologies out there that could change the planet right now if they just got proper funding. But we're at that point now. I mean, when you have all these headlines on CNN unanimously agreeing, scientists unanimously agree across the board that global warming is human-made, and most of the reports, I saw this on CNN again recently, that ExxonMobil was, you know, indicted in charges that they were paying tens of thousands of dollars for scientists to falsify reports or polarize the global warming issue. So they're paid for. The opposition is a paid for, you know, movement to try to, you know, once you polarize global warming, then people don't necessarily have to take it seriously.
Well, it is polarized.
I agree with. But the CNN revealed recently that it was ExxonMobil once again who's paying for the polarization. So it's not like these scientists are volunteering on their own accord.
Yeah, but I don't think all of them are part of that, David.
Well, you know, I mean,
I've talked to some pretty legitimate people who truly believe that we are definitely in a cycle. We may be speeding things up, but, you know, we had global warming hundreds of thousands of years
ago. The last four ice ages were caused by it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's finish up with some calls here, and then we will wrap it up. I can't believe how fast this night has gone by. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with David Cerita. Hi there.
Hi, this is Steve. I'm calling from Denver, Colorado.
Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
First of all, George, I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
For years. David, I got a question regarding singularity.
Mm-hmm.
I've recently connected with an old high school girlfriend, and we've been chasing after each other for like the past 18 years. Mm-hmm. And we have such love for each other, and it's just so incredible. But it's just incredible to me that at certain times I start to say something, and she'll say exactly what I was going to say, or I'll think of something completely off subject, and she'll say, you know, she'll say exactly what I'm thinking, or vice versa. And is that a type of singularity?
Yeah, I think, I mean, as the last caller before this one said, I mean, you know, in her message, love, if you differentiate between two different types of thought forms, if you're in a state of conflict, a dual thought form can only propagate at the speed of light, which is not instantaneous. But love, which is actually a singularity, every single one of us have many singularities inside of us. We have that as a tool. But when we're in a state of love with another person and we're separated over any distances or even we're side by side, the thought transfers instantaneously between the two singularities. And therefore, you know, once again, we prove on Valentine's Day that love is the highest force in the universe.
Yeah, it's just amazing. There are so many times where she'll finish what I'm going to say, or I'll finish what she's going to say, or we'll say the exact same thing at the same time. It's just incredible.
That's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you very much. You guys have a great night.
All right, thank you. Appreciate you being part of the program. I've done that all the time, too, David.
Mm-hmm.
You're intuitive. You're tuned in.
Oh, yeah. It happens to Crystal and I all the time. I mean, we have the exact same, you know, thought transference instantaneously. It's like we know what each other are thinking, and it happens constantly between, you know, people who are in you know, good relationships.
Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. It's your turn. Hi there. Hello. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, this is Myron Price of Salina, Kansas, on 11:50 a.m.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
And first of all, George, I really enjoy your program.
Well, thank you.
And you're just fantastic. And what I wanted to ask you was, on your guest, if he thought that when Adam and Eve was in the Garden of Eden, before they took the fruit, that that universe was different from our universe, and that there's almost like two different universes, and that we went down in frequency, and that it says in the Bible that the whole creation is groaning for the revealing of the sons of God, that when we change, that we'll change the universe with us.
Good question.
Well, I think it's a fantastic question. There's no doubt that when you go from singularity to conflict, that you fall in. I mean, just think about it logically. If two people are in a room and two are in love, and those two people who are once in a state of love start to have an argument, the vibration gets lower. You go into a state of conflict and you become frustrated. I mean, I think the two universes simultaneously overlap each other. There still is the singular real-time universe, which is our universe, but we only perceive the dual universe. And because we're trapped in duality, we can't see those other living beings that are all around us, that are probably on other planets, just like Pythagoras had said and some of the other great masters had said, that paradise is still here. In fact, Robert Thurman said that. He said, this is Shambhala. It's actually right here. And he said the Dalai Lama doesn't really like to focus on the prophecy of when Shambhala will emerge. You can experience it as soon as you evolve, so as soon as you're willing to make that leap. In fact, then we look at the last caller where this woman was communicating with a distant star system in real time. What singularity ultimately proves is that you can actually send information, and it's possible to even teleport physically to another star system or another galaxy instantaneously by evolving this far, if we can actually attain singularity as a civilization. I think once all of humanity, this is to answer the final part of his question, if everybody finally reaches singularity and we evolve past war, I think we will all go to a higher level. There will be a new heaven and a new earth.
Did you know that the Bible makes reference, by the way, to mustard seed?
Yes, of course.
Isn't that weird?
Oh, it is. It's interesting that he chose mustard seed. I need to find that documentary to get his name, because I was trying to track him down, that astronomer. He works at a major university today. I just wanted to ask him, why didn't you pursue that? I mean, that's a major breakthrough. And I think some astronomer out there, and if anybody from SETI is listening, try this experiment. Duplicate it and see, is it possible to use living tissue interfacing? In fact, remember what Colonel Philip Corso said when they autopsied the bodies at Roswell,
yeah,
that they were half living tissue and half electronic, that they were interfaced?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Maybe there's a reason for that. Maybe there's a way to view creating artificial intelligence and interfacing it with living organic tissue where it has the ability to communicate far greater than just, you know, just a kind of electronic kind of dead computer, you know, in a way.
Next up, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, George and David. This is Chris down in Tustin, California.
Sure thing.
Yes, I had the great pleasure of meeting you both at the Conscious Life Expo last year.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. But, Dave, back in 1991, I was on a family trip houseboating on Lake Mead, Arizona, and I awoke to a massive blue craft, and you know, I got to see it for about 10 seconds, then it just zipped away, and you know, it was incredible. But a couple years after that, I was paralyzed in an accident, and I was just wondering if you've
I think
heard.
I remember you.
Yes,
you were boating on a lake or something.
Yes, yes.
Oh
yes.
My God, I remember you.
Absolutely, yeah. I was houseboating, and
right,
you know, yeah. But my question is, have you ever heard of any close encounters or contact where there was healing involved, like, you know, where the person was miraculously healed of any type of ailment or anything?
Oh, I've heard of stories like that, yes. There have been stories where people have had contact with divine personalities or even extraterrestrials where there has been healing. In fact, if you go to the case of Zaytoun zeitun-eg.org on the internet, you'll see. I mean, it's an enormous case. I mean, just go look there and you'll see.
Okay, thank you so much. Wild Card Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
My God, I know that guy.
Go, hello.
Hi, this is Nathan from San Diego.
Hey, Nathan, go ahead.
Hi. By the way, thanks, George, for your tip. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
I wanted to ask David if he has any more great information on the Tibetan or Ascended Masters and their teachings on how to ascend and that sort of stuff.
Well, that's a very huge question. I mean, the practice of meditation in any religious tradition, if it's authentic and if the teachings lead to true states of peace, you have to practice it every day. There's a difference between just believing and wanting to have your own experience. And I think if you practice every day, and you're faithful, I think you will have an experience. You will have your own ascension, absolutely. But it can't be something that is approached superficially. I mean, it takes your entire effort to have these experiences. I mean, I planted trees for 22 years as part of my spiritual path, you know, to ultimately, you know, evolve myself. And I still consider myself absolutely a humble beginner and definitely don't consider myself enlightened in the perspective of, you know, any of the saints, any of the great saints. You know, I'm still on this path. But if you practice every day, the benefits are very noticeable.
Okay, next up, first-time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, George.
Hi.
Hey, it's John. I'm in Huntsville, Alabama.
Hi,
I'm a truck driver.
Sure thing, sir. Drive carefully and go ahead.
And David was talking about how you need to go to a new, a higher level of consciousness to see invisible worlds and stuff. And I was just wondering, since everybody's always looking for Atlantis and nobody can find it, if he wonders maybe that's why nobody's able to find Atlantis, is because it's on a different frequency.
Well, that's a great question. I don't know that I necessarily Atlantis was on another frequency. They may have started on a higher frequency, but when they, you know, when they kind of went the wrong way and apparently the place blew up, they probably became very physical the way we are in the dual universe. But I don't know if in anything I've read on Atlantis, including from Edgar Cayce's writings, to suggest they might have been on an interdimensional level of our own planet.
Okay.
All right, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Not a lot of time left. We'll take some final calls, and then we'll just wrap things up with David Sarita. He's got websites. Mention them again, please, David.
You can get Singularity, my new book, at lulu.com/David Sarita. It's all up on your website. And my new film, From Here to Andromeda, you can pre-order now at fromheretoandromeda.com. It comes out in mid-April.
All right, very good. Let's go to our international line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from Niagara Falls. How are you guys?
Hey, John, thanks.
Just relating a biblical reference, there's a passage, Corinthians 13, talking about love never fails and sort of the nature of how it does not seek its own, and there's a whole list of them. I was wondering your thoughts on that and how it kind of relates to the discussion tonight.
Well, I mean, it's a very general thing to say, you know, love never fails, but it's much deeper to understand the physics of love and how to access it more frequently in our lives, to really feel it. And, you know, I was alone and even celibate for 7 years at a time in my life, practicing my meditation before I met my current fiance. And there are times even, you know, when you're meditating and you're alone where you feel tremendous love and union with the whole. But it's very special to be in, you know, communion with another person on a very deep level. And I think Valentine's Day signifies that, and I think that's why this question, you know, comes up. Love ultimately triumphs over everything. But like Jesus said, if you love one and you hate the other, you still haven't really understood. We have to learn how to love everybody. We have to come to a total global state of oneness before we can transcend war. We really have to do this, and if we're going to survive as a species.
Final call, Wild Card Line. Go ahead, please.
Is this me?
Yeah, you got your last call. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, George. I really appreciate your work.
Thank you.
David, this is a different question than the other questions you've been getting.
Mm-hmm.
7 years ago, my son died in a car accident, and he was 23 years old.
Mm.
And when I was going through the papers of what he had suffered. It was broad daylight, and I was just tormented by the fact that my son had suffered and felt pain. And I had this clear vision, and God gave it to me quite a few times, that when he flew out the car window, Christ was there like a catcher in baseball and caught him, and they were both just laughing.
Oh, what a remarkable story to share with us. Hey, David, we are out of time, but I want to thank you for being on the program. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, George, and happy Valentine's Day to you.
What a neat story to end the program.
Everybody out there.
All right. Wonderful. And don't forget, join us again tomorrow, because we're going to have a very special guest, Mr. Rupert Sheldrake, who is going to talk about his online telepathy experiment. Boy, I'm looking forward to that. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. And as always, thank you for joining and participating with us with Coast to Coast AM. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, Art Bell, Tom Smith, Larry Jones. I'm just rambling on here. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.